And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. We're at the State House, and of course, when we're at the State House, we'll talk public policy, we'll talk politics with some of the leaders here in the building. And today, we have joining us Representative Don Turner, who's the House Minority Leader. Later on, we'll have Senator John Campbell, who's the Senate Pro Tem. We'll have Senator Joe Benning, who's the Senate Minority Leader. And later on, we'll have Representative Sarah Copeland Hansas, which is the House Majority Leader. But first up, Don Turner. Don, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you for having me on the show.
What does a House Minority Leader do?
Well, my main job, I believe, is to make sure our constituents have a voice in what's going on in public policy. So, for lack of a better word, I'm the voice of opposition. So I carry the message of our constituents, our caucus constituents, to Montpelier. I try to convey our position in a respectful manner. Another very important part of my job is to disseminate information amongst my caucus, or our caucus. When you're in the State House, you get very busy. You're assigned to a committee, and the members' focus becomes that work of that committee. So my job is to make sure that they understand what's going on in all of the committees throughout the entire session. So that's probably the primary role of my job as the House Republican leader or minority leader. But I do want your listeners to understand that I take my job very serious in that I am the voice of opposition. I am constantly having to question what the speaker is doing or what the governor is saying and so on. And I take it very serious, and I want to do it in a very respectful manner. I respect the positions that they hold and that they have the majority and that they have the right to do that. But I do want our constituents to have their voices heard as well.
Sometimes people will describe your job as herding cats, that you have a lot of people with a lot of diverse opinions. How do you do that?
It's a very challenging job at times. Very rewarding in many, too. But I come from a volunteer fire department, and I have 100 people in Milton that are in similar things. They work kind of for me. I don't pay them necessarily. They come because they want to help people. It's the same thing here at the State House. Everyone that's elected here is here for the betterment of their constituents and Vermont as a whole. And I just have to try to put the information and show them a path to how we do that. And I do the best I can, and I've been very fortunate and had a lot of support.
So let's turn to policy and some of the things that are happening in the State House. Yesterday, the governor gave a State of the State address. In a few weeks or a week, he'll give his budget address. Let's start with the State of the State. What did you think of the State of the State yesterday?
You know, I was very disappointed. Vermont, a place I've lived my entire life and I love, and I can't imagine ever living anywhere else. However, Vermont has some very serious challenges we're facing right now, mostly financial. And I've got to say, mostly the result of the Shumlin administration and this single-party rule that we have in Vermont right now. He has led us down this path of spend, and not necessarily shown us how we're going to bend that curve. So when in the State of the State yesterday, what we heard was more of the same. You know, he's got some great ideas, but doesn't tell us how he's going to pay for them. I mean, I understand in the budget address there will be more details, but we have some very serious, as I said, consequences that the state is facing, one being the financial stability of the state. Basically, they have spent all of the reserves. They've raised $50 million in taxes each and every year for the last 5 years. People can't afford to live here anymore. And yet the governor doesn't even talk about the state's financial situation in his speech yesterday, nor does he talk about the Vermont Health Connect, which is still a debacle. I mean, he mismanaged that so badly and spent over $200 million of federal money, and yet still doesn't talk about it, we know we got some problems and we got to fix it. Doesn't even mention it, but throws out other things that he wants to do and doesn't tell us how he's going to pay for them. So,
as I'm looking at the State of the State address, I sort of break it down into four categories: the economy, the education, energy, and drugs. You had just mentioned that he didn't focus, in your opinion, on the economy as much as you would want to see. Economy being jobs, cost of living, those sort of things. He talked about the education arena about the expansion of programs for higher education. What's your position on that?
Well, you know, we know that we need Vermont kids to have good educations. If we're going to keep them here after they get good educations, they got to be able to find a good job. And the governor, again, does not really talk about economic development. He talks about the renewable energy world, and the only way that that's been booming is they've removed a lot of the regulatory process, simplified it, made it predictable. We need to do that for the entire economic climate, not just the renewable energy field. So, you know, looking at what he had to say in that area, you know, I believe that we need to do more for Vermont kids. But what we have is Medicaid and the health programs that this governor has instituted sucking the life out of the state budget. I mean, Medicaid is going to suck up more of the state budget this year than ever before. We've seen that part of the budget grow and grow, and the rest of the state budget is being sucked into it.
Let's turn to energy/environment, I guess you would say, on that. He called for the divestiture of the pension funds, I think he was talking about. He wasn't specific. But the divestiture from the pension funds of coal-burning utilities, coal-burning companies, and ExxonMobil, not any other oil company, but specifically ExxonMobil. What's your opinion on that?
I don't even know where he's coming from there. I mean, the treasurer is the person responsible for handling the state's pensions funds and these investments. Now, I don't think politicians should be dealing with people's pensions. I think it should be left to the experts in the financial world. So I don't know what that's all about. I just don't agree with it because, again, I don't think he, as a politician, or even the legislature as politicians, should be dealing with people's pensions funds. And if he's isolating one particular investment, I think that's very dangerous for a politician in his place to do. And, again, I would be very concerned if the treasurer took his lead and moved in that direction. And I think that anybody that has a pension, is due a pension from the state of Vermont, including the teachers, should be very leery of a proposal such as this.
Under the sort of the category of drugs, he promoted legalizing marijuana with some restrictions in it. I think there were five or six restrictions in there. Promoted legalizing marijuana for recreational use. And also, he talked passionately, he has talked passionately about the opiate crisis here in Vermont. But there's the issue that I have is that there hasn't been a good explanation why, if you're opening up on the door on one, why isn't that causing a bigger problem on door number two, which would be the opiate problem? So opening up door number one would be the marijuana issue. Then trying to close door number two, which is the opiate issue, how do both of those reconcile?
I have no idea, Mike. I mean, I'm sitting there just as dumbfounded as anybody. And I had a number of my constituents call me last night and say, did I hear this right? The governor's saying he's going to legalize a drug to help offset the cost of another huge drug problem we have. And that's kind of what I heard him say, so I guess that's what he's saying. I don't agree with it. I don't support legalizing marijuana. But I do understand and appreciate his concern for the opiate problem because as a fire and rescue chief, I mean, I'm on the front lines. I've dealt with it this summer. I was on a call with an opiate overdose. I get it. It's very serious. It's very concerning. We have to help move in a direction to address that issue. But I don't think legalizing marijuana to pay to help opiate addiction is the right way to do it.
We'll turn to the budget in a minute and some of the specifics that you'll be looking for in the budget. But I want to go to the phone line and take a call from Rich from Starksboro. Rich, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Thank you, Mike. I have a question for your guest. When Mike asked you what does the minority leader do, you said you're the voice of opposition. Do you also have a voice of cooperation? Do you also have a voice of serving Vermonters and trying to do the best for Vermont in a maybe cooperative way as well, or instead of polarization?
I do. I'm glad you asked. That's a great question, Rich. I can give you an example. Last year in the education, last election, we heard loud and clear from taxpayers that they needed the legislature to rein in education spending. We came to Montpelier, our caucus, committed to reining in education costs, and actually was working with the governor and the speaker's office, the majority, on how we were going to do that. Act 46, although not perfect, we fought really, really hard to have that cost containment, the caps, in that bill, and we would not support it. None of our members were going to support it if they weren't in there. That bill ended up passing and is now law. I voted for it. I work collaboratively with both the governor's office and the speaker to get that instituted into law, which is working. We are seeing that education, school boards and stuff have to rein in spending, which is going to ultimately have to help the taxpayers of Vermont. So I'm proud of that.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks for your phone call. Let's segue into that, the school cap.
Yes.
The governor calls for lifting of the cap. This was a cap that I believe a year ago that he supported. So now it wishes to be repealed. Do you see the school cap as something that needs to be repealed?
Absolutely not. Repealing the school cap is raising the modern
property tax. Let me just explain what the school cap does is penalize you if you go over a certain percentage of a budget increase. Is that correct?
That is correct. If you're a high spending community and you grow faster than the state average, then this number that we've selected based on historical information, we just didn't pull it out of the air. This came from historical budgets. If you are spending at a greater rate than that, then you would be penalized. Your district would be penalized. This is working. School boards are not happy. And I've had, even in my own community, school boards members call me and say, well, you know, this is going to might hurt us. And we're not a high spending community. I said, I understand, but we were told by the taxpayer that we need to do this. I haven't had a taxpayer call me yet to ask me to remove this cap. So I think it's working. We're going to do our best to do this. Now, I also want to let you know that it's only a two-year cap. So this is a two-year fix. We are going to negotiate this session to make sure we get long-term savings, because our fear is that at the end of the 2 years, we'll see a huge spike in education spending. People will just hold off for 2 years and then spike it. So our caucus is working really hard in the Education Committee to make sure that we have a solution for future long-term sustainable savings.
The budget speech will be next. That's the big speech that the governor gives next. What are you going to be looking for in that budget speech?
Well, I'm going to look for ways that he's going to help us bend the curve here in Vermont spending. I mean, he has spent, his administration and this majority have spent over 5% on average every year since he's been governor. The revenue stream is less than 3%, and we've been living off reserves and raising $50 million in taxes and increasing fees. So the cost of living in Vermont is escalating at a very rapid rate because of the spending that we've seen under this governor and the supermajority and the majority. What we're going to see, because he's not running for office, I'm hopeful he's going to take and really make some tough decisions and rein in some of the spending to put the state in a better spot as we move forward.
We're speaking with Don Turner, who's the House Minority Leader. If you wish to join our conversation, call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. I normally would say call us at our WDEV studios, but we're sitting here at the State House today. So give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. You talk about the governor, the need to rein in spending. Do you have any proposals, or does your caucus have any proposals to rein in that spending?
We absolutely do, Mike. We have well over 30 bills on the walls in various committees that would have a significant impact on state spending going forward. You know, we have looked at this. It took a few years for the governor to get us in this problem. It's going to take a number of years, in my opinion, to get us out of this wholly. We have put bills on the wall that would allow the state to only spend 98% of the revenue stream, which would then allow reserves to build. We have a bill that would lower the state workforce by 10% by the year 2020 through natural attrition and retirement and so on. We can't lose sight of this governor has hired over 700 jobs since he's been in office. He's added 700 new state employees to the payroll since he's been governor. And that is not sustainable when you look at what's going on in state government. So we have to figure out ways to be more efficient. We have proposals. We also are looking at, the state has a large liability in its pension funds. We don't want to spend every nickel on new programs. We want to take some of that money and put it in to pay down the pensions. Because I know, and we know, that in the future years, the out years, that'll save the state millions of dollars, which opens up general fund revenue to do programs that Vermonters need. As long as we keep borrowing and stealing and begging and moving and sucking in everything into health care and stuff, we can't do that.
It seems to me, as you look at the state budget, it needs a budget adjustment because we have a deficit in this fiscal year. We have a projected budget shortfall in the next fiscal year. What's the driver in that is Medicaid. So What are some of the thoughts from the Republican House members on getting the Medicaid costs under control?
Well, we can't lose sight of the fact that Governor Shumlin, like he has it in his tenure here, he says, well, we need to expand Medicaid, and don't worry, it won't cost us because the feds are going to pay for it. Well, I think he's wrong, because we're seeing these huge problems in Medicaid. One of the things that we have been pushing for,
and just for the listeners, it's a 60-40 split or thereabouts. The federal government pays 60%, we pay 40%.
Right. So there's a lot of state dollars going into this program, even though the governor said, oh, no, it's not going to be any cost. So what we have proposed is that looking at eligibility, the Shumlin administration had mismanaged Vermont Health Connect so poorly that they've got a waiver from the federal government that they're not even checking eligibility for people that are receiving Medicaid benefits. So we've said, you've got to expedite the eligibility process. So that's number one that we think has to happen. Number two is we're looking at benefits. Vermont has the most generous Medicaid benefit package in the country. So we're looking at ways to maybe shave some of those benefits off. Premium assistance on health insurance, things like that. Those are areas we're going to have to look at. We don't believe in Vermont right now that Vermonters are paying equitably from lower income to higher income for health insurance. So we think that we need to look at that. So those are some areas that we have bills that we're putting forth. We're working with the Joint Fiscal Office. We're bringing these proposals forward now. But we've got to bend this curve, because I just don't see it changing in out years.
We talked briefly about marijuana in sort of the opening segment, talking about the state of the state. Is legalization of marijuana going to pass this year in the legislature?
I hope not. You know, I really hope that the legislature does not rush and pass this bill. I know the governor said he wants it with 05 contingencies, I guess. I'm not sure how he worded it. But I don't believe Vermont is ready or needs to be legalizing another drug when we're facing such an opiate epidemic and all these other financial problems. I think we just have to get our state finances in order. We have to get things reined in and get the government on a sound basis, and then start looking at these things like marijuana or whatever that are interesting to people. But I can't support it as a public safety guy. I work closely with our police departments and stuff. It doesn't make any sense to make their job even more difficult and give people another opportunity to do something that the governor says we're going to have a low tax, so it'll beat the black market. I don't think any tax, because the black market's paying no tax. So I don't know what he's referring to there either.
Carbon tax, we're going to see that this year?
We're not going to hear it, but I know that the Natural Resources Committee is taking testimony. So they're not going to bring it out this year because it's, don't forget, an election year. They don't want to bring out a new tax in an election year. But Vermonters ought to be paying attention next year, because I think they're going to push that through.
Mandatory paid leave.
It's already out of the House. We didn't support it. I don't support it. You know, we talked earlier, Mike, about the economic development climate. The small business are struggling to survive in Vermont already. And to put another burden on them at this time, I just don't think is wise.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Bob from Plainfield, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Just a quick question. Aside from the $200 million that was originally invested in Vermont Health Connect, I understand that the maintenance cost for that system is fairly high. Do you have any numbers on that?
I do. Thanks for your call. The cost to operate the Vermont Health Connect is total about $46 million. Now, there right now is a partial federal-state match. The state's spending about $18 million, and the feds are making up the difference. That program, that Vermont Health Connect, I don't know how Vermont is going to sustain the operating cost of that going forward at such a high cost, but it's about $46
million. Let's... One of the subjects that I've seen the gubernatorial candidates talk about, and I wondered if it has any legs here in the legislature, is gun control. Any thoughts on that?
I haven't seen. I mean, there was a bill that passed last year that passed the House anyway, and I believe it passed the Senate that did some registration information. You know, but I don't think there's any. It doesn't seem to be a real appetite amongst leadership in the House. Speaker Smith, anyway, to take on anything any more in depth in gun control than what already passed.
Let me ask this question: does anything change? This is an election year. Everybody's up for an election. Does that change the dynamics in the building?
I think it does, Mike. I think it does. I think people are aware when they are, you know, up for election that, you know, their votes are. They pay a little bit more attention to their votes on raising taxes and things like that. So I'm very optimistic that you won't see a big tax increase this year. But on the other hand, I'm kind of concerned on how they're going to fill these big budget holes without doing that. And I'm hopeful that means making structural changes to the base budget, because that's the only way we can fix this problem is structural changes to ongoing programs. And I've called a number of years that every committee should spend the first 4 weeks of this session scrubbing every single program under their jurisdiction. I've talked to the speaker about that. I've hammered that, but he doesn't want to bring that up and doesn't want to do it. But I don't know how we're going to get to the bottom if we don't start looking at everything.
Last night, quite a spectacle in Burlington. Donald Trump was in town. What do you think of Donald Trump?
I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump. I'm glad he's not afraid to speak out. And I think that's why a lot of people are resonating toward him, is that he says some stuff that I don't agree with. But I don't know. I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump. I'm glad he came to Vermont, though. And I wish every candidate would come to Vermont, because I think Vermonters deserve to hear these people speak and to see who is running for president. So I was glad that he came to Vermont. I'm glad that people are paying a little bit of attention to Vermont. I think it's good for Vermont economy if they come. But again, I didn't go, and I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump.
Have you endorsed anybody for president?
I have not endorsed anybody at this time. I've been solicited by a number of organizations working in the state for different candidates. I'm going to let it play out a little bit and see how it goes, and you know, continue to listen to my caucus and see where they're going. But it's a pretty wide open field, as everybody knows, and I don't want to get into a place where I endorse either too early or. And historically, what I've done is wait till after a primary and then get behind the candidate that wins.
I want to thank you, Don Turner, the House Minority Leader here at the State House, Republican member from Milton. Thank you very much for being on Open Mic.
Thank you very much, Mike, and I look forward to coming back again at some point.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
This is Open Mic.
Once again, back to the State House and Open Mic with Mike Smith.
Welcome back, everyone. Sitting next to me is Senator John Campbell, who's the Senate Pro Tem. Welcome, John.
Well, thanks, Mike. I appreciate it. And also, congratulations on your show.
Well,
and
thank you.
I like to hear it when I get in range, and that's usually what I'll throw on when I get there.
You know, I can hear it from Windsor County when I'm back home. So.
Well, you have a better radio than I do. Maybe my XM radio gets it. I don't know.
What does the Senate Pro Tem do?
Well, actually, as the pro tem, it's you're the acting president of the Senate when the lieutenant governor's not there. But generally, it's I consider it almost like representing the entire Senate caucus, and that being both caucuses, the Republicans and the Democrats, and trying to manage floor time, what issues will be coming up to discuss. Probably the most important aspect of the pro tem comes at the beginning of the biennium, when he and the lieutenant governor and the person we call the third member of committee on committees gets together to determine who is going to be on or which senator is going to be on what committee. That is a major issue. It's one that myself, Lieutenant Governor Scott, and Senator Mazza, who's been the third member, we take at least 2 months, really, to make those decisions. We start right after the election thinking about who you would have there. At that time, we come back and we try to look at all the strengths of everyone. One of the things that I have done specifically since coming in is I have insisted that we have be extremely fair across the board with Republicans, Democrats, and of course we have progressives now in the Senate. So I believe it's extremely important that we have fair representation across the committees, which is kind of tough sometimes because the Republicans, we don't really have like the 15 or 14 that they had years ago. So I try to help out as much as possible to make sure that we get their viewpoint.
I'm just curious, any lobbying that goes on for committee assignments?
Yeah, there is. There is. You know, there'll be folks that say, hey, you know, I really, really would love to be on appropriations. Of course, after they just got elected, it's kind of tough to say, well, there's about 29 other people ahead of you. So,
I think when I was a freshman legislator, that was my request to be on appropriations back in the 70s. And, of course, Timmy O'Connor brought me into his office and said, you were just elected. You're not going to be on appropriations. What did you think of the state of the state yesterday?
There were parts of it that I really liked, and parts that I was looking. The governor was probably a little more lighthearted than you normally would expect. So I figured, well, maybe the next gig he's got is one of the late night shows. But no, actually, it was good. He, you know, Governor Shumlin is one who will deliver a good speech. I particularly like when you bring people in from the community that have been affected by one thing or another. And this is done by most governors, that they'll mention someone. But yesterday was extremely emotional in the Laura Sobel, when she, you know, bringing her family in. And the two young women who were found, you know, who discovered themselves in the grips of heroin addiction or opiate addiction. And to see them succeed is something that's really personally rewarding to me. And anything we can do as a legislative body to try to help that along, I'm supportive of.
Was there anything in the speech that gave you pause?
One of the things probably is the divestment issue. I do have some concern there. I'm somebody who believes in relying on my experts to tell me what to do, and you know, we have a tremendous state treasurer. She is somebody who's shown her mettle for a long time. I think she's been fair across the board. She's not political. In a situation where you're dealing with divestment of funds, you know, our responsibility as a state is to make sure and ensure that the retirement funds of our state employees are going to be solid and there. Now, with that said, I mean, I think it's a great idea. I mean, if we could stop investing in oil stocks in a situation, coal stocks, I would support that. I mean, I would, if I had my own portfolio, that's not something I would invest in. With that said, though, you have a we have mutual funds in the state, and it's kind of hard I think it would be difficult to kind of pick and choose which ones. So I'm going to rely on the secretary, I mean the state treasurer, to and her team to advise me on whether that is a good idea or one that should give us all pause.
The McAllister situation has been resolved temporarily. Senator McAllister from Franklin County has been suspended by the Senate on a 20-10 vote. What's the next move? Is an ethics commission something that you would support?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have been through since last year, when even prior to this issue coming up, we we've had issues that we wanted to make sure to revamp our sexual harassment policy or and I hate to use just that because it's really more than that. It's not just sexual harassment. It's really we should, as legislators, as those people who, you know, we should hold ourselves even above the other organizations because we make the laws. We should have something in place that is a guideline that deals with how one respects another, and whether it be male, female, just regular colleagues, male colleagues, or whatever. And we also have to understand is that and this is my personal opinion, that sitting here as a senator is a privilege, one of the greatest privileges in electorate politics. And we have to guide ourselves, our even personal lives, that you know, that if you're going to put yourself in a position where you're breaking laws, then you should not be sitting as a legislator. And again, in the McAllister issue, he's innocent until proven guilty, no question about that. But what we are saying is this was not a criminal trial. It was not a criminal hearing. It was a hearing, if you will, almost an administrative type of hearing, something that any public organization would do if it was a school board, if it was a select board, if it was a public employment. The person, if someone had been, these allegations had been levied against a person in their employ, they would have been immediately suspended until the outcome.
Secretary of State Condos has recommended sort of this independent ethics commission. Would that be something you would support?
I would have to see that, because that deals with the statewide offices, the ones that he's talking about. I think we need here in the Senate, we need to, I can't talk for the House, but speak for the House, but I would assume that they're going along the same lines, but certainly a group, whether you want to call it ethics panel or I think ethics panel is probably the best way to describe it, where if there were any complaints about a senator, sitting senator, that they could be brought there, whether they be by some member of the public, whether it be by a colleague or just someone here in the State House.
Marijuana, is that going to pass this year? And let me explain. Yes. Not marijuana. The legalization of marijuana.
Well, I think they talk about passing it a lot. I don't know personally. I don't abide, but I've heard that they do pass it around sometimes. In fact, I believe there's a song about that. But it is an issue, as the governor talked about yesterday, and clearly I think everybody within the state knows that there's a big push to legalize marijuana. Personally, as I've said and I've been on the record, is I don't personally support that. However, I am not going to as the Senate pro tem, use the power of my office to try to stop that, because there is clearly a wide or there's a large amount of support throughout the state for legalization. And so, and part of that kind of gets to where my concerns are. Because there are a group of people who feel that they want to see it legalized so that we can raise lots of money, and they think that we're going to raise lots of money, and that it's all going to go to either lowering taxes or balancing the budget. And for me personally, I believe that if we the thought of trying to balance our budget by making a previously illegal substance legal is really a sad, sorry state of affairs. So I certainly, if it goes for legalization, I will not be supporting it if the funds are, you know, planned to be used for that purpose. Again, I think the governor's pointed out many of the issues, that many concerns that I have and that should need to be answered prior to it. I know that our committees are going to be working on it for the next few weeks, and I've given it sort of a timetable, because I certainly do not want this to be the only bill that we deal with this year, or the major issue that comes out. So if they are able to put together a policy where all the answers that the governor, or the questions that the governor had, are answered, and then some that I have, I think that you know, there's a possibility it could get through the Senate.
In a few weeks, in a week, the governor will be giving his budget speech to the joint legislature, the Senate and the House. What are you looking for in that speech?
Ways to balance a budget. And as you know, it's interesting because, you know, all the years that you were here, this is an exercise that the administrations go through, and of course you guys have it the toughest because you start out and try to figure out and get your pencils out. And you know, it's one of the things that many of the people out there in the general public who may not be aware of how the budget is really put together. You think, oh, I can just cut this program, or I can cut that, and I can cut this service. But they don't realize that by cutting a service or cutting a program, especially one that's linked to federal funds, that we sometimes that would be short-sighted, and that we would find ourselves in a bigger mess than we were before in trying to deal with it in another fashion. And I think that also begs a question of, so when the federal government comes knocking and with money in its hands, should we run the other way? And oftentimes I think some of the things that we've accepted federal funds for, we probably should have run the other way. However, we have an issue. We have a current shortfall, which that we're dealing with from last year, and then I believe that my understanding is that the administration will be coming in, of course, with a balanced budget to present to us. And I'll be interested to see what they do as far as in the Agency of Human Services, which, as you know, is that's really where all the money goes. Every other area of government sort of feeds that budget. And it's Human Services is kind of a misnomer, as you again know, because people think, oh, that means just that's DCF or that's just the social service programs, when it's not. I mean, that's corrections, that's health care, it's a myriad of issues. It's a huge megillah. And so that's one of the reasons why I am strongly supporting and pushing the thought of restructuring the whole AHS system. Now, I know you guys have talked about it. Everybody's talked about that for a long time, and it is a huge job. And the question is, will there be savings by doing that? And I'm not sure if there is. I think there certainly will be more efficiencies that are found. And I also think that if we start peeling back the onion, I can't help but to think that we will find things that we are not even aware of that are happening within these departments and within this agency. So I'm looking forward to that.
One of the drivers that seems to be causing the budget problems, both in 2016 and 2017, is Medicaid.
Right.
It's put the state in a hole in the current fiscal year. It's projected to put the state in the hole for 2017. Any thoughts on how you get Medicaid under control?
I think that's that gorilla in the room. And as you know, those are also, again, getting back with federal funds is a 90-10 match, in most of the situations. And
in a lot of the situations, 60-40.
60-40 and other, right, yeah. Exactly. And I think what it comes down to is understanding how we can really get health care under control. And I'm not trying to skirt the issue here, but health care is a huge part of that Medicaid, because Medicaid pays for a lot of things, not just health care itself. But the rising costs in health care is causing a major problem. And then, of course, looming on the horizon is what are the feds going to do with us? Are we looking at waivers? Are we doing this or that? Are waivers good for us? Should we look to try to attain them? But I don't think that we will ever be able to get a hold of the Medicaid budget unless we're able to find a way to control healthcare costs. And I know I'm not trying to again punt this question. It's just that it is so complex, as you know. And so I'm hoping that I have a lot of faith in Steve Constantino. He's our new I consider my the czar over there. And I'm really impressed with his knowledge, his base of knowledge, and him being able to give a thoughtful look at alternatives. And so we have a meeting set up with him, I believe, next week to discuss this, or within the next 10 days, and because I think this is the problem that's not just facing us now. This is going to continue to face us within the next five years, you know, 7 years. Who knows? But anyway,
carbon tax. Is it going to is one going to be proposed and passed this year?
I don't think so. Let's put it this way. Let me answer the question. Will one be proposed? Yes, I think that there are some folks that would like to propose one. Do I personally support it? The answer is no. It's not that I don't support the fact, the underlying idea of what, you know, again, I am absolutely 110% in favor of trying to get us off of our addiction to oil and fossil fuels. Is the carbon tax the way to do it? And are we putting extra pressures on a general public, especially, you know, the areas or groups, you know, the middle class, the lower, you know, the people who are struggling to pay their bills in the lower social economy. Are they ready to be facing, you know, more charges for you know, at the gas pump? Or so I don't know. I know that our transportation committee chair would probably not support it, and so
yesterday the governor in his state of the state addressed two issues. One was mandatory paid leave, and the other was removing the cap of Act 46, the school tax. What the cap does is penalize those school districts that spend beyond the statewide average. Right. in there. Do you support removing the cap?
Yeah, absolutely. I've never favored it to begin with. I didn't favor it last year. The reason why we had it was obviously a compromise in order to try to get Act 46, or that whole theory, out and into working mode. I think Act 46 has done a really, really incredible job, or what some of the intentions were there, because take away the caps for a moment. We, for the first time, I think, have people talking with one another. We've had some successful mergers already. There's many that are in the works. And I think this was directly as a direct result of what we did with the education, with that education bill. Again, the caps, I did not agree with them. I thought what we had in place was sufficient. I have told my chair that I would like to see them repealed, and they are taking that up as we speak.
Mandatory paid leave. Your right. Position is going to. The bill is passed the House, if I remember correctly. It's in the Senate. Senate going to take it up and pass it this year?
The paid sick leave, yes. And I'll tell you why. I have been a major, a vocal, I won't say opponent, but a vocal. I was very vocal in my concern for this bill. I believe that our small businesses throughout the state are just now making it through, trying to get past that, you know, out of that recession. And they're working under tremendous pressures as it is. And I did not want to do anything else that was going to add to any pressure that might prevent them from making a full and successful recovery. And as a result, the people who were supporting this bill or sponsoring the bill, they reworked it time and time again in the House before it got out of the House. I have had that bill reviewed actually by many local businesses in Windsor County to just see what kind of impact it would have. And some of the folks that I've dealt with or talked with, friends who own the businesses, who were totally against it before, and then they found out what it really did and what it really said, then said, well, it really won't affect me that much. And some said, oh, we're doing that anyway. So I do support that. I think we're now at a point where, number one, the bill's in a position where it does not put as much pressure on the businesses as it did originally or thought. And second, I think it's a good idea for the employees who have been the backbones of these businesses and have stood with their employees, employers during these rough times, that now that they also understand that they're being respected as well.
You were a proponent of gun control in a very concise way last year, I think.
Yes.
is accurate in how the description
yes.
was. Do you
see any further action on gun control this year?
And just if I can, just to sure. Relate to the, your listeners, what my major issues were, there were two last year. One was to make sure that violent felons did not possess firearms. And second, that neither did people who have had serious mental health issues. There was another portion of the bill which had to deal with background checks, which that was part of the bill. And as you know, when you go to put bills together, sometimes people attach other parts. I personally support, you know, the eliminating the loopholes in the background checks. However, that's on a personal level and maybe on a nationwide. I look now, you know, Vermont's a little bit different than the rest of the country, and fortunately so. However, that's changing, Mike, as you know. We're talking about people who have come into our state now from New Jersey, Massachusetts, New York, and they're peddling the drugs. And I know as a state's attorney and a prosecutor, I'm seeing more gun violence in this state than I saw before. And quite honestly, if you look to see who's committing this gun violence, it's not you're not your native Vermonters or your folks that have been here for a long time. It's not the same people who have our same, I think, thought process. So, but again, with that said, I still believe that convicted felons or violent felons should not have weapons. I don't believe that people who have mental illness should have weapons. Are there things now that we can do? I think it's important to see where President Obama's he did the executive action. That I think is going to go a long way to answer personal questions that I have, again, from a national scope. But I don't think there are any other bills that are this year have been introduced to expand, at least not that I know of.
So let me just get this a little bit straight. Universal background checks you would support, but on a national level. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think at a national level, that's where you have to look to see where the problem is, you know, with background checks. Quite honestly, the background checks, almost every gun dealer that I know in the state of Vermont does background checks. Even if they're not required, they do them. I think where my concern lies is at the gun shows, and that's what the loophole about people selling them out in the parking lots. Again, a lot of people at gun shows, very responsible gun owners here in Vermont, will go ahead and do that. But for the ones that don't, I think that we need to take a look at that, because people are coming to areas like Vermont, I believe, and are buying, now taking advantage and realizing that, hey, wait, we don't have these background checks up here. And so I think that there's a more of a potential for that happening. And I don't want to see our Vermonters get a black eye and get into a bad situation to where somebody from down in Jersey is coming up here, buys a gun, and then goes back, kills somebody or kills a cop, and it's traced back here to Vermont.
It's election year this year. Anything change in the legislature during an election year?
Oh, God, no. No, it's going to be an interesting year. I mean, let's face it. We'll have a new governor. We'll have a new lieutenant governor. We're going to have a new speaker. I, right now, I'm hoping to come back in my position, and I would hope to be reelected as pro tem if I do. And there's going to be, I think, a lot of...
Does it change the dynamics in the building because of so many changes in terms of
I think it does.
Getting things passed?
I think it does because there's been, even when Governor Shumlin went from pro tem to governor, there's always still been that, he's had, as you know, a little bit of that hand, that control in the Senate. And the Speaker, of course, has been steady and static. And so you're going to have a shakeup. You're going to have a difference. And I think there'll be a shift I don't want to say power because I hate that word, but a shift in where who's going to be and the types of people who are going to be laying out where we're going to go in the future, laying those roadmaps.
I want to thank you, Senator Campbell, for the time.
Well,
I know you're a busy day. Have a busy day. And a busy
heading
time.
Back to play lawyer and to prosecute a couple cases today, so later this afternoon after I finish my business here. But thank you so much for having me on. I really do appreciate it. And I want to tell you, Mike, you're doing a great job. And for your listeners and for Mark's former listeners, I think that they've got a great replacement.
Well,
we'll have you on more often if you keep saying things like that. Thank you.
I just want my own gig. I've been trying to get it for a few years now.
We've been speaking with Senator John Campbell, who's the Senate pro tem. Coming up next, we'll check in with our friends at Talk Media News, and then Senator Joe Benning, the Senate minority leader. And then later on, we'll have the House Majority Leader, Representative Sarah Copeland Hanses. She's the House Majority Leader. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, we're always streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. We'll be back with more. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's this time of day that we head down to D.C. and talk to our friends at Talk Media Radio and Victoria Jones. Victoria, good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you this morning? I'm at the State House in Vermont. I'm talking to various legislators and having a good talk about the issues in Vermont. What are some of the issues in D.C.?
Well, the issues in D.C. May be similar to yours. One of the issues in D.C. is the question of whether your citizens have their coats or not.
Can you elaborate a little bit?
Following last night's Trump rally, those protesters who were thrown out, and Donald Trump kept saying, no coats, confiscate their coats.
Yeah, Victoria, I was there.
Yeah?
It was interesting. I mean, first of all, there were 1,400 people in the what is called the Flynn Center for the Performing Arts, which is in Burlington, Vermont. There was about 1,000 protesters outside. Secret Service told me that was the largest protest that they have ever seen in this election thus far. And you're absolutely right. 4 to 5 times there were disruptions in his speech, with people disrupting the speech. They were quickly removed. One gentleman wanted to go back for his coat, and the Trump people got him out. But I think he did eventually get his coat. So it was an interesting sort of thing. And maybe you've seen this or talked about this before, or have seen this at various rallies with Donald Trump, but he focused. There was a centerpiece that sort of was the center, and then there were spokes that went out from that center when he talked. He talked about 1 hour, 10 minutes, but his centerpiece was Iran and the nuclear deal with Iran and how bad that was. And then, you know, what was interesting to me, he does not have any problems bashing other Republicans. He does not adhere to the Reagan rule, which is you say no evil about other Republicans. So that was my take. What have you heard about him?
Oh, absolutely. He has no problem bashing other Republicans. He has no problem bashing anybody at all. He's very happy to bash people. He claims that it's only when he's already been hit, you know, that he likes the counterpunch. I'm not sure that that's entirely the case. He seems to do a fairly good job of just punching as well as counterpunching, although he's definitely a good counterpuncher. But yeah, we certainly heard that it was an overflow crowd of Trump supporters, and that there was an enormous protest against him in addition. And outside the arena during the day and in the evening in very cold temperatures, and that he gave an hour-long plus speech that, as usual, was a bit meandering, touched on a lot of different subjects, and that there were a number of protests who, as usual, he called for security to have ejected, and he is really the only Republican, is my understanding, who has gone to Vermont, to Burlington, which to a certain extent gives him a certain amount of kudos, because like why throw away any votes if you can get votes?
Yeah, and Victoria, I was surprised by the crowd, actually. I mean, it was, you know, not everybody got in. And it was only, there was only 1,400 seats, very enthusiastic crowd. And you often think Vermont that wouldn't be the case, but very enthusiastic crowd. Of course, some of the protesters, but I think most of the I was surprised by the size and the enthusiasm of the crowd in Vermont.
I saw interviews with a number of people saying, well, Trump's my first choice, but Bernie is my second choice. Or other people saying, well, Bernie is my first choice and Trump is my second choice. And I thought
that weird?
Was very interesting. Yes, yes. Yes.
So what is happening down there now that we've talked about just what Donald Trump wants us to do is talk about him in Burlington?
Of course. A couple of things. One thing is... the December jobs numbers are out, and they were better than expected. What was expected was about 210,000 new jobs in December. What we actually got was 292,000 new jobs in December. So about 80,000 more than what was projected by economists surveyed by places like the Wall Street Journal. The unemployment rate, which is obtained through a separate survey, held steady at 5% last month. So that was considered good. Also, revisions showed that employers added 50,000 more jobs in October and November than previously estimated. So both those months were better than have previously been reported. So you usually do get revised numbers, and of course they always go up or down. So the last 3 months have been better than had been thought. Wages held nearly steady. So that's the one thing that people are always looking at, that this modest wage growth is a concern, because a tighter labor market, experts say, should really be leading to better paychecks, and it should be bringing about consumer inflation, and it's just not really happening.
Two things have been dominating the news the last few days. One is the issue of the Chinese economy, and it sort of had a hiccup and it sent a cold through the world markets. That seems to be stabilizing this morning. And the other issue is North Korea. What do you hear on either of those issues?
Well, yes, China does seem to be stabilizing today. European stock markets also have stabilized, and Wall Street seems to be responding fairly positively so far. It's early, obviously very early on Wall Street this morning, but so far seems to like what Asia and Europe is doing, and seems to like the jobs numbers. But it's early days, and you know that they're fairly nervous Nellies down in Wall Street, and we'll see what they do for the rest of the day. But there's a bit of hope. As far as North Korea is concerned, today is young leader Kim Jong Un's 33rd birthday, and many. North Korea watchers think that the what is widely believed to be a fake hydrogen bomb test was timed to be just a couple of days before his birthday, deliberately. These dates, you know, birthdays, anniversaries, commemorations, are very important in North Korea. So it was not an accident that it happened just a couple of days ahead of time. As you know, yesterday, I think it was, or it might even have been Wednesday, South Korea started blaring propaganda music and stuff again into North Korea, which it had stopped doing. Well, now North Korea started blaring propaganda into South Korea. So now you've got a battle of noise going on over the border there.
Hey, Victoria, thank you so much. That's Victoria
Jones from Talk Media News Service, I really appreciate the time and your expertise. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I'd like to welcome Senator Joe Benning, who's the Senate Minority Leader. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me.
What does a Senate Minority Leader do?
I suppose that depends on what the Senate Minority Leader's caucus wants him or her to do. In general, my responsibility is to try to gather those members and have conversations on a regular basis about the legislation that's being proposed around the building, what, if any, positions that we want to take on those situations. Occasionally, we get thrust into a press conference or two to talk about general things, but by far and large, it's to just try to guide the group of nine, now eight, into a conversation about virtually everything we see in the building.
One of the first things that the Senate did when it came back, I believe it was on Wednesday, was vote to suspend the Franklin County Senator McAllister. That vote is over now. Is there something else that needs to be done, like an ethics commission or something in that line?
I've been an advocate for an ethics commission for some time, and it was one of the first things I noticed when I came in the building after having served as the former chair of Vermont's Human Rights Commission. I got a hold of the sexual harassment policy that the Senate has, and I first noticed that it was about 20 years old. Now, as you can imagine, there's been quite a bit of litigation over the years on this subject, and more recently there have been many different policy arguments that have arisen where we are suddenly looking at our lives in a much different way than we have before. And as a result of those policy discussions and the ancientness, if you will, of that policy, I recognize that there were changes that needed to be made to it. Part and parcel of that conversation is developing some kind of a neutral entity that can make sure we're actually abiding by whatever that policy is, and an ethics commission would fit that very well.
I'm trying to figure out what this commission would look like. Would it be a creature of the Senate, or would it be something like Secretary of State Condos is recommending a different commission?
We've actually had some conversations about this in the Senate Government Operations Committee. We've gone around the table talking about that question, and I'm not sure yet we've reached any kind of a consensus. There was some discussion initially of it being totally in-house, where you would have senators who were of different parties, who were elected on a rotating basis, having a term limit of some kind. There's been discussion about it appearing in some other function of government, but then you get into the question of, okay, how do we pay for that now? The conversations are ongoing, but I suspect as a result of the activity we took this week, you're probably going to see those conversations gelling.
Let's turn to the State of the State address yesterday that the governor gave. What's your thoughts on the governor's speech?
I was very much feeling like I was on a roller coaster, frankly. There were some things about it that I can really support. For instance, when he has a conversation about the need to make changes to protect our social workers, that's something I think everybody can get behind. When he introduces the children of Laura Sobel, everybody in the building stood up, and I think that was one of the longer ovations that you heard. The next thing that I would be hearing would go along the lines of, we're about to have 25 or so new positions, I think it might have been 27 new positions, but there wasn't any statement about how we're going to pay for that. Are we going to have a new tax that's going to cover that, or are we going to cut some other services? I left that speech and went down into government operations and was immediately confronted with a group of current state employees who are worried that their jobs are going to be taken away from them because the state wants to put their positions out for bid to see if there are private enterprises that can take over at least some of those services. So I'm thinking, all right, there are conversations happening behind the scenes while he's having a conversation with us in the front parlor, but out the back door there's something else going on we haven't heard about yet. Those kinds of things were happening in my head throughout the speech. I mean, literally, I was going up and down trying to support some things and thinking that, oh boy, this is going to be a problem.
The legislative agenda for the Senate Republicans this year, what's at the top of that list? Or give me a few things in that,
the
on that list.
The same list that has been on the top of that list since I've been here in 2011. We would very much like to see a reasonable, sustainable budget. If we keep spending at 5% when we're growing as an economy at 2 or 2.5%, those numbers just don't mesh. And every year we come back for a budget adjustment. Every year we go through the pain and the trauma of people threatened with their jobs. And we keep doing this to ourselves, and it just seems like we're going around in a circle that never ends. So I would say one of the top priorities for the Senate Republicans is to try to get that under control. We have been beating that drum for the 5, now 6 years that I've been here, but it just doesn't seem to get answered in some way. So that's problematic for us. Another thing is that we need to be attracting jobs that are not just service jobs, but jobs that are more substantive by way of manufacturing. And anything that we can do for those who are entrepreneurs in this state to advance their cause. So concentrating on any legislation that might accomplish that is very important. And I'll give you two examples that I'm trying to work on now. This may seem very small to a lot of people, but if you happen to be somebody who manufactures beer in this state, and we have a lot of them, for some reason or other, if you have a manufacturer who is producing a quality product of beer, and that person wants to sell that beer, they can't sell it at a restaurant that they own. They have to go through a distributor, sell it to the distributor from the manufacturing location, and then have the distributor sell it to them at the retail location, which makes absolutely no sense to me. So why not eliminate that? We're going to work on that. The other is we have a number of places in this state that sell beer at the retail level, but can't sell in a growler that's capped in order to consume it off campus. It's a small thing to a lot of people, but to those people who are involved in the business, it generates an income for them that they currently don't have. So we're piecemealing it with some things, but that's the spirit of what we want to get behind.
I want to turn to the budget in a bit. I mean, the budget is the next address that the governor will make, but I want to take a phone call. Let's go to Dick in St. Albans. Dick, you're on.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
I can just barely hear you. Your volume's way down. Anyways, after listening to Senator Campbell and Senator Benning, this is all the more reasons why we've got to remove the lawyers from the state legislature, because they're extremely bad influence on the process of making law, and basically they're down there for one purpose, is self-serving interest.
Senator Benning?
Well, Dick, I was, long before a lawyer, I was a radio disc jockey, and I also played guitar through the years. When I was first entering the workforce, I shoveled driveways, I sold newspapers, and I drove a truck to deliver pharmaceutical supplies to people who needed them.
You're big pharma.
I didn't actually walk into life as a lawyer, and I would prefer not to end life as a lawyer, quite frankly. But I hear that kind of statement all the time. The reality is, lawyers are not the dominant feature in this statehouse. There are a whole lot of other occupations here, and lawyers certainly do have their own desires, but so does everybody else in this building.
Thanks, Dick. I appreciate the phone call. The budget will be the next speech that the governor gives. What are you looking for in that speech?
Well, first, I will be sitting in my chair with a notepad, writing down anything that red flags me. And I am still hoping against hope that what I'm hearing is a way for us to keep taxes down and sustain a budget that will be able to continue without one-time funds or federal grant money that seems to disappear.
one of the drivers in the budget problems that we've been having, especially in 2016, and as you project sort of the gap in 2017, is the Medicaid budget. It seems to be out of control. So how do you get that under control?
If I knew the answer to that, I'd probably be a rich man. I was alarmed when I heard that about one-third of our citizens are currently receiving some form of Medicaid benefits. That's appalling to me, and they may be limited benefits, but the idea that that number of our citizenry is actually qualifying for those benefits, to me, indicates a change in our culture. And trying to reverse that trend would be one of the things we would want to try to work on. As far as paying for what's currently out there, I think that's going to be a major lift. I'm glad I'm not serving on the committees that are going to be responsible for that. But I have yet to hear any really substantive ideas on how that's going to change.
Senator Campbell today said that we need to do a reorganization of the Agency of Human Services to better serve Vermonters. And in that was his thought that it may save some money. Any thoughts in that area, given that you're in government ops?
I've heard that as well, and I will have to acknowledge that the numbers in that agency are quite vast. It sometimes makes sense to divide in such a way that management is better apt to understand what individual components of that organization are doing. But I also have to keep in mind there's an overall forest, not just those individual trees. So as of yet, while we've had some basic discussion about it, we haven't seen any specific proposals. And I want to see those proposals and figure out how that's going to impact us financially before I would be going in that direction.
The governor calls for lifting the cap on Act 46, and the cap basically will penalize you if you spend above the statewide average. He had actually called for a cap, I think, a year or maybe two ago, but now is calling for lifting the cap. Where are you on that?
I want to be where my constituents are. And I think right now I've probably been to 15 of the 23 towns in my district, either school boards or joint meeting of school boards or supervisory unions in that district. They are universal in screaming that they have a major problem in front of them because they have costs that they cannot control, health care, cost of fuel, etc. Our intent in passing that bill was to try to make sure we kept a lid on expenses. We have a mechanical device in place now that attempts to do that. But the reaction that I'm getting from school boards now is that, in fact, it will not put a cap on expenses. It's going to cost the towns more because they're exceeding the cap. They have no other option other than to literally cut programs for the kids. If you're going to have a problem maintaining your programs, and it's leading to unjustifiable cuts in those programs, where my child is not getting the education my child needs to have, that's a little concerning to me. If, in fact, it's going to increase property taxes in an unexpected way that we couldn't have anticipated when we first passed the legislation, that's also a problem for me. The overall reason that I voted for the bill was that I always theorized that the bureaucracy at the supervisory union level was a place we could save money. And by consolidating districts, we were going to narrow down the personnel who were in those top management positions and thus save money. I know that that is actually happening. So we are doing something to move the pendulum, if you will. But right now I'm concerned because I'm hearing so much noise from my constituents that I think we have to take a second look at it, and I'm not sure where I'm going to end up in the end.
You've been an advocate for legalizing the recreational use of marijuana. Is that going to pass this year?
I don't think that's one of the top priorities in the building. There has been a lot of work that's happened over the past several months with the Senate Government Operations Committee. It is now a subject of discussion in the Senate Judiciary Committee. That's, in fact, where I just came from. But there are a lot of things that need to be dealt with. The governor was actually quite right when he outlined the five situations that he was concerned about. We have attempted to take care of all of those in the bill that you're going to see starting to be talked about more. But there are still some things that have a lot of tweaking to do and several committees probably to run through before they ever get to the bottom of whether that will be
What would be a couple of those things that need to be tweaked?
One of the things we have to make sure we're not getting involved in is a massive influx of tourists who are crossing state lines under the influence. That's going to bring the federal government right into the picture. We have a situation where people will come into the state to use. You have to figure out where they're going to be using it. The federal government is still considering it a Schedule I drug, and as a result, banks are not going to accept the money, although the banks are talking about how to get the money and deal with it now. In fact, I came about 2 weeks ago from a bank meeting where they were talking about what they specifically intend to do to try to get around this. So banks are moving in that direction, but there's a lot of tweaking that needs to be done, and we have a budget that's completely out of control in my eyes right now, so that's the number one top priority.
Last night there was quite a spectacle in Burlington at the Flynn Center for the Performing Arts.
Sorry, I missed it.
There was a presidential candidate, Donald Trump. What's your opinion of Donald Trump?
I have made no secret that I do not support Mr. Trump's rhetoric. It is something that I would be reluctant to see as the standard bearer for our party. But there's a lot of frustrated people out there about what's going on in the world, and I understand why they're leading towards somebody who is being very blunt and outspoken about what they intend to do, and frankly, in my eyes, a little harsh in what he wants to do. But in my best world, the Republican Party is in desperate need of a standard bearer who is level-headed, is intelligent, and has accomplished things that would make sense from a legislative perspective, not necessarily from a business perspective. I am also concerned that Mr. Trump has absolutely no ability to work with Congress. And despite a lot of his rhetoric, he still has to get his initiatives passed through a Congress. So are we leading ourselves down the road to more dysfunction? I guess time will tell.
I want to thank you, Senator Benning, for coming on the show today. I appreciate your time. I know you're very busy. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're at the State House today, and we're talking with various representatives who are in leadership positions. We talked to Don Turner, the House Minority Leader, Senator John Campbell, the Senate Pro Tem, Senator Joe Benning, the Senate Minority Leader, and now we're speaking with Representative Sarah Copeland Hanzes. Did I get that right?
That's Hanzes? Correct, yeah.
Who is the House Majority Leader. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
What does a House Majority Leader do?
Well, you know, we joke sometimes that it's a little bit like herding cats, and I think the more apt analogy is that you're trying to transport your frogs in a wheelbarrow, because every, you know, on any given issue, you have people who are trying to hop out, and you want to try to keep enough frogs in the wheelbarrow to move some legislation. So it's my job to connect with the 85 members of the caucus within enough advance times that if there are concerns about the direction that a particular policy is going in committee, that we can meet those concerns before the bill comes out and comes to the floor.
And how do you do that? You have caucuses and what's the mechanics of making sure that you've rounded up the cats?
Well, you know, it's really all about communicating. You know, I was 100 years ago, I was a teacher before I decided to stay home with my kids for a few years. And teaching is really about communicating ideas and understanding what the recipient needs for information, and then being able to communicate with that with them on that. And I think that being a state representative is really about communicating back and forth, you know, between your constituents at home and Montpelier. So the job of majority leader really just kind of takes all of those communicating skills and demands that you do it on a very fast time schedule. So, you know, you got to know what's coming up, and you got to work backwards from there to make sure that you've provided folks with the information about what's coming up, so that they can feel like they've been had their questions answered, they've had a chance to check in with their constituents at home. And so we do a lot of written communication, a lot of just networking around the building. We've got a number of folks who are on a leadership team, so it's really not just me. I'm more of the captain, kind of directing people.
As the captain of the party, the majority leader, people will assume that you're in line to be the next speaker. Is that true?
Well, you know, Schaap wasn't majority leader before he became speaker, and so it's certainly not a hard and fast rule. And I think that, in my observation, the person who becomes speaker is the person that that demonstrates to their colleagues that they have the willingness to work hard and the skill set to do the job. And so I don't think there's anything that's a foregone conclusion. And
are you interested in the position?
You know, the position is very much something that I am curious about. It's a very important job. I am not 100% convinced that I can adjust my time schedule with my family obligation, and I have a small business that I own. And so, you know, I will certainly continue to think about it and work toward that. If I need to adjust my time schedule, I will.
Let's turn our attention to issues going on in the building. Yesterday, the governor did his State of the State address. Mm-hmm. What did you think of it?
You know, it was much more calm than last year. Last year was a little anxiety-provoking.
And that's because there were protests within the well of the House last year.
Yeah, and, you know, there was a lot of energy leading up to the State of the State address last year, as a significant number of Vermonters felt so deeply disappointed that the governor put the brakes on a move towards single-payer health care. And, you know, this year it was, you know, it felt more like an opportunity to, you know, take a deep breath, reflect on where he's come in his governorship, and he certainly laid out a few things that he would like the legislature to help him out with in his last year.
Was there anything you particularly liked in that speech? Was there anything you particularly disliked in that speech?
I really appreciated his words about needing to take an aggressive stand on the number of opiate prescriptions and the volume of opiates that are flooding out into the communities. We have all heard the stories anecdotally that you go to get your wisdom teeth removed and you come home with a 30-day supply. There's no need for that kind of flow of opiate substances out into our communities, and you know, we need to take an aggressive stance on that. And he laid out a couple of different concepts of how to do that, and I will be pursuing those because I think it's so important. If you can prevent somebody's addiction in the first place, then that is far more powerful than any millions of dollars you can put into substance abuse treatment.
Anything in the speech that caused you some concern?
So I think that for me personally, and I really need to differentiate between my view and the view of the caucus, because the caucus, I think, is so far kind of undecided. Marijuana was an issue of concern for me going into the speech yesterday, and I actually was a little bit relieved to hear the governor really flesh out five aspects of a legalization bill that he, you know, that are a requirement for him, because a lot of those areas of concerns are the ones that I'm hearing about from not only from my constituents back in Orange County, but also from some of the members of our caucus who, you know, we're not teed up in the House right now to begin work on this because it's been understood for quite some time that the Senate was going to take first crack at the bill. But as we've been educating ourselves and looking at the experiences in Colorado and Washington and really trying to understand the lay of the land and what legalization looks like, those five things that the governor listed are are the most common concerns. And so, you know, it was nice to know that he's asking for that to be an aspect of the bill.
Do you foresee a marijuana bill passing the legislature this year?
I think it has kind of long odds, just kind of from my observation of things. But you never know. I mean, sometimes things come together in strange ways. You know, there are a lot of people who've expressed concerns, but at the same time, those people also say, if my concerns are met, I'm not going to stand in the way of it. I don't, you know, maybe I don't like it, but it's the right way forward. You know, I think we're going to do this in the Vermont way, and the Vermont way is to really, you know, take in all of the thoughts and concerns, do our best and most judicious job of meeting those concerns, and then move forward when we know we're ready.
The next big speech of the governor is the budget speech. What will you be looking for in that budget speech?
Well, I would like to know, you know, what the governor's thinking is in terms of how we, A, cover the Medicaid shortfall now, but B, set ourselves up so that we are biting into that kind of structural shortfall that we have. And that shortfall that we have is no surprise. I mean, there's a couple of contributing factors that we can talk about why it's as large as it is. But that structural shortfall is something that we all know about, and I feel it in my business, and I feel it in my family finances, and that is that the cost of healthcare is rising faster than income or faster than revenue. And so we have known that for some time, and we're working on instituting policies that will help us slow the rate of growth of healthcare, such as the Blueprint Community Care Teams who operate out in communities and really help make sure that there is the right care for people to keep them well, so that you stave off you know, hospital stays or readmissions in the hospital or progression of conditions like diabetes or asthma to the point where somebody is debilitated and needing expensive medical intervention. But, you know, we've known for some time that that Medicaid is growing, and in fact, it's one of the reasons we continue to tackle healthcare reform overall.
Medicaid is one of the drivers that's causing some problems. It's causing some problems in 2016 with the budget adjustment. It's causing some problems in the budget gap for 2017. The things that you mentioned, the Blueprint for Health, for example, that has long-term results. Mm-hmm. But you got a budget gap in the next 2 years.
Yes.
How do you tackle that? With these are not small amounts of money. I mean, even if the majority of this Medicaid is paid for by the federal government, but there's still, you know, depending on what you're spending on, it's either a 90-10 split, or, and that's on IT, various IT operations, but it's a 60-40 split in other places. How do you get that under control?
You know, I think it's going to involve a deep look at all of the areas of Medicaid where we're seeing higher than expected growth. And we have to remember that Medicaid is not just health coverage for poor people. Medicaid is also where we offer premium assistance to folks in the exchange. It's also how we help senior citizens with their Medicare Part D donut hole prescription drug support. There's Medicaid spending in schools with some special ed for young people, and it is also where we're funding a lot of substance abuse treatment and addiction treatment, mental health treatment, and those are all areas of extreme importance in our communities. I mean, if we can't offer substance abuse treatment for folks who have become addicted, we're just going to continue to see that cycle of crime in our communities as people, you know, struggle to be able to buy the drugs that their body so desperately needs. So how do we get that under control? I think it involves looking at all areas of Medicaid and looking at who are the Vermonters that are most expensive in each of those areas of spending, and are we doing enough to make sure that they get the care that they need, get the service that they need, get well, so that we don't continue to pour good money after bad. In the same way that our community care teams kind of wrap around somebody and try to figure out why it is that, you know, that that asthmatic continues to end up in the emergency room, I think we can also look at each of our areas of Medicaid spending and find places where a little bit more or a little bit different care would bring us a better result for the individual Vermonter, but also a better budget trend.
One of the concerns, at least, Medicaid is governed by what is called global commitment, which is a waiver from the federal government. And one of the aspects of the waiver is that you're able to expand Medicaid into a lot of areas that normally wouldn't be allowed to expand Medicaid. But in return, the federal government is required a cap. And what the cap does is say, if you go over the cap, you, the state of Vermont, have to pick up the entire amount of any amount that goes over the cap. Is there any worry about going over the cap?
Well, I think if we were to do significant expansions, yes. I mean, we're not talking right now about expanding into different areas necessarily, but we do need to make sure that we're managing well with the programs that we've already started, you know, Choices for Care being one, you know, that helps aging seniors stay in their home as opposed to kind of being forced into an institutional nursing home. And it's a wonderful program. My grandmother aged in her home, and she died in her home with her family around her. And it was hard on the family, but through the support of, you know, Choices for Care, she was able to get her visiting nurses in, and she was able to to really have that quality of life that she wanted. And I'm sure overall it was much less expensive than if she had been in a nursing facility.
Speaking of caps, the school cap was in the governor's speech yesterday. He wants to remove the school cap that was put into the budget or into legislation last year. Mm-hmm. The cap basically says that a school district will be penalized if it spends more than the statewide average. What's your opinion on removing the cap?
So, you know, there isn't a clear consensus among House members that I've been able to discern yet. There's a lot of talk about it, and, you know, we knew coming into this first week of the session that this would be one of the issues we would need to look at quickly in order to give some clarity to school boards from around the state. There have been a number of proposals. There are strong voices who are saying do nothing. There are strong voices that say, and in fact, our House Education Committee, I believe, will come to consensus that they would like to simply raise that threshold by 0.9%, which is the calculation of how you would hold school districts harmless for one of the things that's out of their control, which is the increase in healthcare costs to the school district for this particular year. I think that 0.9% increase does bring a lot of schools back under the threshold, keeps them out of that penalty phase. And of course, the governor has talked about a delay, and I've heard other voices talk about an outright repeal. So it's clear as mud right now.
One of the things that some are advocating for is a carbon tax. Will we see a carbon tax this year?
I doubt it. But, you know, we've been having a great and jolly conversation about it because, you know, the folks who have strong desire for us to move away from our dependence on carbon are very thankful that we've been having this robust discussion about it because, and I think that, you know, indeed they would say that other states around the region are also going to begin looking at taxing carbon as a way of helping people move off of carbon. But I don't see that going anywhere this year.
One of the things that the governor talked about and one of the things that has been prominent when I talked to the speaker is mandatory paid leave. Will we see a mandatory paid leave, sick leave bill go through the legislature this year?
Well, you know, we passed a modest universal paid leave bill last year, and it was a bill that I worked very closely on. because in previous years, the proposals that had come before the legislature made me uncomfortable as a business owner. And they made me uncomfortable because, you know, because they were a little too generous, too aggressive, and I felt like they didn't institute the universal sick leave benefit in a way that, that really recognizes the character of Vermont's small businesses. And so I worked hard to make sure that while we are looking at making sure that workers don't have to choose between a paycheck or their job, and being able to stay home with a sick child or get a doctor's appointment that they need for themselves, we did it in a way that is modest and incremental, and it's a benefit that is offered to long-term employees as opposed to you walk in on day one and you can take 3 days off next week. And you know, that was one of the concerns that we heard the first time around. These are long-term employees. These are folks who presumably have already established their positive contribution to a business. And the thing that I like about it from my perspective as a business owner is, you know, I employ a lot of moms with young kids. We help each other out. We know that we have to cover for each other if one of us has a sick kid. But the reason that sick kids fall disproportionately on my business and cause me to have to shuffle staffing is because the dads don't have a paid sick leave benefit. And if the dads had a benefit and the moms had a benefit, then it wouldn't be every single time that there's a sick kid that my business has to scramble and shuffle to cover a shift. You know, we could see some of the dads being able to stay home with their kids as well.
A lot of changes at the State House. There will be a lot of changes at the State House coming into the next year. You have a lieutenant governor who's running for governor. You have a speaker who's not seeking re-election. You have an incumbent governor who isn't seeking re-election. Does the dynamic in the State House change this year at all as people sort of jockey for positions?
You know, I would imagine that at some point we'll begin to feel that. I think right now we're you know, at the stage of kind of setting our agenda and figuring out, you know, what are the things that we want to accomplish here as a legislature, as a House and a Senate. You know, in Vermont, you don't really need to start a campaign for re-election until after the legislature is over. So while we have declared candidates just because the timing of the governor's announcement and all that, you know, I don't expect there to be a lot of heavy politicking for the governor's races, governor and lieutenant governor's races.
Do you foresee any gun control legislation?
I don't, although, you know, I mean, certainly we hear chatter now and again. There's a lot of people who have concerns about gun safety, but I haven't seen anything that looks like it has a strong head of steam. You know, we did a very Vermont bill last year, and while the gun rights activists weren't maybe 100% pleased, they were willing to continue the conversation at the table, and I think out of respect for that conversation that we had last year, I won't personally be pushing for any gun legislation.
I want to thank you, Sarah, for your time and your expertise in the various areas. I hope you come on again, and I thank you for your time. I know you're very busy.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Representative Sarah Copeland Hanzus. She's the House Majority Leader. And just a programming note, I will be filling in for Hester Fuller for the next two Mondays. So I will see you on Monday. We've had a very good discussion here today at the State House. We've had a very good discussion all week long, whether it's about Donald Trump or other gun control, other things as well. So I thank you for all your phone calls this week. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. You can hear our podcast by going to that website. I'm Mike Smith. We'll talk again on Monday.